Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Hello and welcome to episode 176 of What Most People Think. And it's cold, isn't it? Cold, isn't it? Have you ever thought, you know when people say those weird rhetorical things to you, have you ever thought of just being a spoiler and going, nah, that really piss them off, wouldn't it? It's cold, isn't it? Nah, not really. This time of year is about right, you know, it's not cold. Well, hasn't December come around quick? No, it hasn't. Aren't young people rude today? No, they're not actually. There are a lot of things. They aren't rude. If anything, they're too fucking nice, you know. That's why I always get uncomfortable whenever they serve you food and they go, enjoy. What do you mean, enjoy? What have you put in my food? But anyway, welcome to What Most People Think. If this is the first time you're listening or you're just getting into the podcast, it is a weekly topical comedy / interview. So it takes a lot of forms, right? So thank you for the people that stick with this ever-changing format. And we explore the socio-political areas which are left underserved, shall we say, by the rest of comedy. Not that it's an echo chamber. We have people from across the spectrum. Last week we had Catherine Ryan on, and this week we've got John Holmes. Well, I think John might be a lefty actually, but he's one of these, you know, these mad fucking lefties that is happy to talk to people from all sides of the fence. And John's got an incredible career to talk about, coming at things from a different part of the industry. You know, he started off doing, you know, he made radio his goal. He didn't come at it from stand-up originally, and he's been involved in some interesting stuff, some controversies you're going to want to hear about. Him getting the biggest fine in commercial radio ever. And he's also involved in creating comedy on the radio, which is trying to get different voices in it. And he speaks in a fascinating and funny way about the issues of class and diversity in comedy. Just a great bloke to listen to. Really enjoyed the chat. Before I chat with him, and also I've got to talk about the rail strikes and whether the RMT, are they slowly losing the room, are they? Because I've had a lot of support the RMT, so I'm going to quickly do that before we get into the chat with John. We've got a couple of things to catch up on. David Domain is back. He's fine. He's Domain talking points. He's sent them all through to me. And he, going back to the Catherine Ryan episode, and David picks up on a point that Kath made. She was talking about the hypocrisy of Justin Trudeau. And she mentioned that Canada exports a lot of asbestos. And it turns out this is true. I mean, Canada has been a major exporter of chrysotil or white asbestos. It was the world's fourth biggest exporter behind Russia, Kazakhstan and Brazil. There you go. There's three nations that have got zero fucks to give, hey? Russia, Kazakhstan and Brazil. Bet they're all buying petrol off each other. Canada ships about 150,000 tons a year to developing countries such as India, Indonesia and the Philippines, where little or no protection exists for workers of exposed populations. So there you go. That's classic Trudeau, isn't it? That's exactly what you'd expect from a geezer like Justin Trudeau. We say people kind, guys. We say people kind. And then the moment the camera's off, send that fucking asbestos to those fucking pork. We've got new patrons. We've got a new board member, Ian Spammon. I mean, I don't know what I can add to that name, Ian. I'm sure. Is that a code name? Spammon the Gammon? Is it? Oh my God, is that what they call you at work? If you're in your 50s and you work in a place where there are any young people, Ian, I can guarantee you that they will call you Spammon the Gammon. Ian spam javelin. That's one of the greatest euphemisms for penis I've ever heard. And so, Ian, you're a board member. So just a reminder to board members, I got in contact. Check your messages because I got in contact for your extra special board member gig. And I think it is a good one. So check those and get back to me with the information. I will start dispatching this secret gift at the secret board member level as early as next week, I think. And if you're not a board member right now, you can just go into your account, edit up your pledge to 20 quid or above, and I'll get in contact with you too. And remember, there are plenty of benefits as well at VIP level. And Richard Norris, thank you for signing up, Richard. You appear to have to have had to sign up about 8 times. I don't know why. Patreon is just killing me because I got eight emails saying that you signed up. Either that or there is 8 Richard Norris's. 8 Richard Norris's out there. I mean, Richard Norris, I hope that you're like a cool guy, Richard, because Richard Norris, if I had to imagine Richard Norris's name, Richard Norris is not, Richard is going to be a bit like that. Yeah, we're just, Richard Norris on the Zoom here. Just got a couple of questions, guys. Yeah, I know we're running a bit over time. Richard Norris would be the guy that would ask the supplementary question, wouldn't he, in any other business. Yeah, just, I've just had one or two issues with the vending machine here at Crawley Branch. And we did actually flag this with building and systems admin, but it has been a while. I don't know, Richard. Send me a photo of yourself, Richard. I'd love it if your reality exceeded the prospect of your name. Let's do a quick thank you and a fuck you before we talk about the ongoing issues with the RMT strikes. A thank you. I did a corporate last week, a corporate gig for Glotel Telecom with my friend Scott, who I've worked with before, and it was a lovely gig. There were such nice people. They were about 50% international audience, I don't know, maybe 40%, and it was a really interesting challenge. You know, the gig went well, but just trying to go through your head and think, what are the cultural references here? There was one point where I started a routine about chip pan fires, and I just thought, well, this is a fucking why are they going to give a shit about chip pan fires, Jeff? Maybe that was like a very British thing. So if in doubt, right? If in doubt, what I've learned in comedy, just pick a bloke in the front row, right? Especially either a very old bloke or a very young bloke. A very young bloke's good. Good looking bloke. He's got his life in front of him. The prick. He's going to be shagging for the next 10 years of his life. Just give him shit. He could take it. He's young, you know, if he's old and he's still in a job, you know, he's retiring soon. He doesn't give a shit. So I'd like to thank everyone that turned up to that gig, and I hope you had a great night. The fuck you is to, somewhat randomly, is to communism. Yeah, I've decided, I don't like it, guys. I don't like it. I mean, the thing is, I've been listening to this podcast called The Dictators. Very good, right? So instead of going through the history of like a country, it takes the dictator as the lead person, and you get to find out about how these regimes came into being and what made the people that led them tick. And I know that a lot of the anxiety that we have politically is always about the rise of the far right, and we should always be, what's the fucking word, vigilant about that. But you look at like the most murderous, repressive dictators, so many of them are communists, right? If you look at your Pol Pots, your why are you pluralising them, Jeff? I don't know. That's what they do in sport. Your Stalins, Lenin, Corbyn, anyone that ends in in. They start from the point of view, right? They start from the point. This is the problem with the left, isn't it? Because you go far off the spectrum, like socialism, you know, 5-5. But there's this tipping point, isn't there? We're going to liberate the people. Oh, how are you going to do that? Everyone's going to have enough rice. Oh, we've already got rice. What do you mean? Why we should have more stuff? Don't just try and give everyone the same amount of sort of mediocre, low level shit. I want more rice. Fuck rice. I want nicer stuff than rice. No, everyone can have the same rice. We're sick of all these. It just seems to emerge, doesn't it, from the politics of envy, doesn't it? That's the main thing. Is they see rich people and go, this is bullshit. We're going to take that wealth. We'll know how to redistribute that. And so everyone's going to be a bit richer? No, everyone's going to have the same. Everyone's going to be poor. Great. Awesome. I think that's the problem, isn't it, with communism generally, is most people go, well, I'd rather be poor with the prospect of being rich than just everyone being poor forever at a stable level of poverty. You know, oh, by the way, you're going to be poor, but you're not going to be destitute. Oh, awesome. Yeah, let's sell that to the people. And Pol Pot as well was the worst one. I mean, at least with like Lenin and Stalin, they sort of had a plan, and you know, like if you leave out the millions of people that they murdered, which conveniently a lot of sort of historical discourse does, they sort of were flexible and they moved. I mean, Pol Pot's one was just such a sort of nihilistic. Sort of, like, we're going to go from year zero, and they just fucking killed all the doctors, and they just kept finding new groups in society to demonize. The fucking, in the end, who was it? The peasants who had more rice than they needed. They became these fucking flash pricks with slightly more rice when they need. Nah. State's taking control of that, mate. You've been creaming off the fat for too long. You got too much rice. Do you know what I mean? Basically, the goal of a lot of communism seems to be to make everyone live like, you know, that bit in I'm a Celebrity where they're just existing on rice and beans. That seems to be the goal of a lot of communism. So I suppose listen to this series, which I highly recommend. It's just a reminder that the left, it's cuddly up to a point, isn't it? It's cuddly. We're just doing nice things. But when it trips over, man, by God, does it come murderous and repressive very quickly. Okay, let's have a quick chat about the RMT. Right, so we've had a year of rail strikes, haven't we? Is it summer of last year? I don't know. Anyway, we've had a while. We had quite a few rail strikes. And it's unusual in a way that it's had quite, compared to most strikes, that it's had quite broad public support, you know. People have empathised. We've all had a sort of squeeze on our living standards, and the RMT are saying, I want more money. And we're going, yeah, everyone should have more money, you know, even though if everyone got like double digit pay rises at this point, it would actually fan inflation. So whatever pay rises did come, certainly a percentage of that would start to be eaten up. But we sort of understood, you know, the principle. There was an atmosphere of support, and the RMT did well in early knocking, certainly against the government. They've come across well. The problem the government have had is that they've had a sort of ever-changing carousel of leaders. So the government ministers have been like, a bit like the sugar babes, haven't they? The lineup has been changing. Meanwhile, the RMT have been offering up one person, Mick Lynch, who people seem to respond to very well, because he's, you know, he's together. He seems quite calm. Doesn't seem quite as angry as other union leaders. It doesn't seem like a Guy Ritchie villain like Eddie Dempsey comes on. Eddie Dempsey's like, I said to him, I couldn't and I wouldn't accept that order. Do you know what I mean? Whereas Mick Lynch comes on, he's a bit, well, you know, he just seems like, you know, a bloke that your dad would drink with, Mick Lynch. And consequently, the usual playbook for the right-wing press hasn't worked, right? They normally just call them union barons, you know, they sort of like do a thing. You know that weird thing where their face moulds from one person to the other, so it goes from Mick Lynch to Scargill. But it hasn't worked with Mick Lynch because he seems reasonable and grown up, and he does the rounds with some interviewers. They all try to sort of land blows on him, and he bodies them. Have you seen this on social media? Mick Lynch just bodied Piers Morgan. You go, well, he made some good points. A lot of destroyed, lacerated, eviscerated. A lot of it just comes down to somebody just making some good points, right? He bodied them. So he sort of wins these early rounds, and then the RMT strike, and they strike again, and we start to realise that the strikes aren't just the day or two that they're happening on. They often affect the day before and the day after. So, you know, they can be up to like 4 days of either no travel or disruption. And meanwhile, you know, your average commuter is frequently spending hours delayed, or so they decide to drive, and then some fucking prick called India, you know, glues her face to the M3. And you know, maybe it starts to change a little bit, because it's just really aggravating when you're spending your time just trying to get where you need to be to do what you need to do on a simple level, right? I just need to get to work. I just need to pick my kids up. I just need to go to a doctor's appointment. And so this public support that originally kind of egged them on a little bit, it starts to wane a bit. And you never trust the public to keep a certain point of view. They're selfish pricks, right? I mean, just bear in mind that even at this point, on YouGov polling, 20% of people still think that nightclubs should be shut permanently, right? Still, just because of COVID, 20% of people just think nightclubs should be shut forever. And you know, like, people start to reassess things the longer it goes on. Train drivers earn well. You know, that's always been a problem for the RMTs. We are aware that for the job that they do, that it's a good wage, but there are other people, you know, within this RMT union, a lot of other people that don't earn at that level, you know, so you have to take that into consideration. But on the other hand, they do have this job where they can leverage the government because it's infrastructure, isn't it? Getting people to work. They can essentially hobble the government, and a lot of people don't, you know, a lot of people don't have that option in the job that they're in. So the offer that they've made is Network Rail's made the offer of 8% over 2 years, and the RMT come out, and as well as, you know, sort of striking twice in the run-up to Christmas, so the Christmas party season, they've got kind of fucked that up the arse. Can you do a better, can you think of better words there, Jeff, than that they fucked that up the arse? They, you know, no, I can't. So they've done that, and then early in the new year when people are going back to work, they've there's two strikes in early January as well. And this hurts people. That's the point, is whatever the motives are with the rights and wrongs of withdrawing your labour, this people are the collateral, right? And then, so they don't like this new pay offer. And they announce one which starts on Christmas Eve. And I know that it doesn't start till 6 p.m. And, of course, there wouldn't be train travel for the next couple of days. But just symbolically, I think that that is the moment of overreach. I think it's a poor move. It's a poor move because it starts to move public opinion. Because it's like it's almost like we don't give a fuck. You know, that's the message that that they care. They've always come out and said, you know, we're obviously sorry for any inconvenience caused. But this sends out a message that they're not. And the problem is for the strikers, so for the people who are on the picket lines, they would have had a lot of support from the people. Because in a way, I guess, as people were angry with the Conservative government, anyone that was going up against them, they were sort of, you fucking too right, mate. Like van drivers going past, go on, I'm too fucking, tell Boris to fuck off. I mean, it all gets, in the same way that the independence movement is sort of linked in with, the Scottish independence movement have linked in with a sort of anti-Tory, fuck Boris thing. So was the strikes. And then, you know, those people that have been buoyed up by the support, like, oh, yeah, I think we should strike some more, but the public are loving it. They can't get enough of our strikes. Then it changes, doesn't it? It gets a bit colder, you know, then they're striking over Christmas. Got pissed up wankers coming up to them going, you ruined Christmas! My grand can't get back! My fucking grand! Like, they're unhappy about other stuff in their life, but they suddenly see this picket line and they take it all out on them. And so I think it was a bad move, right? I think it's a bad move symbolically. And people say, well, why should they give a shit about symbolic stuff? Well, they did with the Queen, didn't they? They did with the Queen. So I think that they should have considered that here. And the issue that they might run into is inflation will start to come down inevitably, you know. And then the double-digit inflation is a very strong argument for double-digit pay rises. That will be gone. And we'll see the impact of prolonged reduced travel because of working from home, and you know, like bit by bit, this situation where Mick Lynch was out bodying Piers Morgan might seem like quite a distant memory. So, look, I'm going out on the piss on the 22nd of December, and I tell you something, you know, I've tried to be more supportive of the unions this year than before, but I tell you this much, Mick fucking Lynch, if you announce another strike on the 22nd of December, I'll tell you what I'll have to do. I'll have to get an Uber home from London because I am not missing a piss up for anything. What most people think. Okay, let's get into the chat with John Holmes here. As you'll hear at the beginning, I was recording this on Monday morning and it took me a while to get my arse in gear. Okay, I'm delighted to say making his debut on the what this is recording on a Monday morning, so I'm keeping that in, and I'm not ashamed. A guy having done so much radio will fully understand that kind of me choking into life. There is the brilliant John Holmes. Welcome to the show, mate.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks very much. That was, you know, the first time either of us have probably spoken today, wasn't it? So that I can understand. You know what happened?
There was a bit, and I think I might have done this recently in the gig that I saw you at Crawley, where I was talking about that kind of hangover that you get, whereby the first time you're that hungover that the first time you speak in a day, your voice scares the shit out of you because you go, it's just deeper and weirder and raspy.
Yeah, as though you've become possessed during the night. Yeah, as though you're some sort of demonic entity has crawled into you.
Yeah, like, did you ever get
which has happened to us all.
It has. Well, that's the mark of a good night, if a demonic entity crawled into you. Some people pay for that, John. Have you ever had that voice where, you know, you ring somebody on your phone and you get the voice of Satan, where it goes, and it doesn't...
Oh, yeah.
What the fuck is... Has anybody ever discussed whether that is actually Satan trying to communicate?
A sort of portal to another dimension. And I mean, you're right, you might be onto something there, because I don't think that's been scientifically investigated.
I mean, I've never said anything, oh, by the way, that's just a sort of feedback from the master. I think that Satan may be, well, I mean, it's an incredible place to start, really, talking about Satan. And I think that, I'm not saying that you're obviously Satan, but you are...
I think the implication was there, but yeah, go on.
Well, you know, you've done some naughty stuff in your career, but we will get onto that. I think for, you know, that phrase, a great voice for radio, it used to be used like as a sort of like an insult about how people look. But I can remember the first time I heard you on a radio, I just thought, I want to listen to what this bloke's saying because of how he sounds, right? And how early were you sort of aware of that when you were in the industry? Did people actually talk about just your voice and how it comes across? Because we often overlook the simple sort of dynamics of what makes something work, don't we?
That's, you know, I've never been asked that before. That's quite an interesting question. So as a kid, I was always, I have no skill set, right? I have jokes and I have the radio. That's all I have. Much to my dad, who was a builder's utter despair. he's like, what are you doing? Why can't you put a shelf up? And I could do a joke about something. And I was just into radio from a really, really early age. And I don't know whether I just sort of absorbed its rhythms.
Yeah.
Because it's like music, I think. And jokes work like this, because you'll know. It's sort of musical, isn't it? Because rhythms and how words structure together and how they form and how sentences form. And if the rhythm to a joke isn't right, it won't work. Mm. Even if the words are the same, the rhythm has to be there. And it's all part of that. And I don't understand it, but I'm totally fascinated by it. And the voice thing, I mean, I've never really thought, because I'll listen to people on the radio and go, oh, that's a good voice. Mm. That they've got an amazing voice. So I worked hard to bash the Midlands out of myself. Which sounds like a euphemism for growing up, doesn't it?
and then the Peaky Blinders came along. You know,
made it cool.
It was like sort of Burberry getting its second life, wasn't it? That something that was once kind of roundly mocked will eventually become fashionable. But it's certainly been one of those accents that people are quite open about mocking, really.
They are, yeah, it's always been. When I first moved down, so I grew up in Nuneaton, right in the West Midlands. And while it's not quite Birmingham, there's a sort of Birmingham edge to that accent in Nuneaton, right? So my folks are still there and they still sort of have it. And I went down to uni in the South, and it just dropped away because I was surrounded by, you know, Southern scum. Yes. So it just sort of fell off naturally. But there are certain words that I catch myself saying that hark straight back to the very heart of that accent. So one of them is basically, if I'm not concentrating, I'll be talking and I'll go, well, the thing is, and you know, I'll give you an example because the window cleaner's just turned up. He's doing the window here. So I might say, oh, the window cleaner's turned up. And basically, he's, and it would just slip.
Actually, normally.
He's doing the windows really well out there. It's great. but it turns out it's the only accent I can do at all. I mean, I cannot do accents apart from that one.
That's interesting because your voice sounds quite like sort of malleable. It's got that resonance and that tone that tends to work well, you know, for radio. And you when I was looking at your CV and stuff, you've done so many, you know, like different jobs in and around radio. But of course, I'm going to be drawn to the time you got fined a record amount of money.
That's right.
An on-air stunt. I mean, are you cool to talk about that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
75 grand.
Well, it's worse, Jeff, right? Because the fine was £150,000.
Right.
And we should probably explain what it was for, because people who may not know are probably just going...
Definitely got their attention, I'd imagine, with that sort of money.
Yeah, and it remains the largest ever fine.
I love the pride with the way you said that there.
I do. I didn't even get a certificate from Ofcom. Didn't even get one. Disappointing. And what it was, I was doing... So it was 22 years ago.
Yeah, okay.
But still now it follows me around and renders me mildly unemployable. Back in 2000, I was doing late nights on then Virgin Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a regular, I only did it for 6 months till it all came crashing down. But I had a regular slot on a Friday and it was called Swearing Hangman for the under 12s, right? And the idea was that you got kids under 12 would ring in at midnight, so midnight on a Friday night.
Yeah.
And their parents would wake them up and get them to play. So their parents were helping them play the game.
Right.
Okay, so it was fully parental consented.
PG.
You know, it was exactly that. Yeah. It was a PG certificate. But the more sort of confident I got with the game because it was funny, the more sweary it got as we went along until it just transgressed the line by kicking it out of the way and stepping over it in a spectacular fashion. So I remember it well. 9-year-old Katie, she was called, and her parents were helping her.
Yeah.
And I asked her about a day at school. And the way the feature worked was because, of course, if you're listening, you know much earlier than the child what word is coming.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So she had a five-letter, a three-letter, and a four-letter little phrase, right? Mm-hmm. And it was to win a CD. Of course it was.
Yeah.
Right. And so she was going, okay, so right, here we go. Let's play Swearing Hangman for the under-12s. Go. So Is there a cert in it? Yeah, there is. It's the first letter of the first word, Katie. That's great. Good start. Okay, is there a T? Is there a T? And I went, yeah, it's the first and third letter of the middle three-letter word. And you can hear a parent sort of going, asking me if there's a P in it. Is there a P in it? Yeah, it's the fourth letter of the first word. Anyway, she spelt this out, and what she spelt out was the phrase soapy tit wank.
Soapy tit, incredible.
Right. Yeah, yeah, right. So, and it turns out, but you can't do that on the radio. And then I just said to her, when she said, you know, is it soapy titwank? And her parents go, soapy titwank, say that.
Yeah. Right?
And I just said, yes, it is, Kate, you've won a CD. Shout it as loud as you can. And she just went, soapy titwank. And I went, here's Deacon Blue. And
that's the clincher. That's the topper for me. Here's Deacon Blue.
And at that moment, I can hear Ofcom's phone ringing off the hook. And then £175,000 was mooted for taste and decency. And this is a big lesson in how the media works, right, early on, because the boss phoned me up. He went, right, this has happened. And I went, yeah, but you loved that feature.
Yeah.
You were the one who encouraged me to do it and said how well it was going, how funny it was. And he went, yeah. But on the record, I didn't know you were doing it, and you're a maverick, and you're fired. And that's a deal we've cut with Ofcom to halve the amount of the fine. Oh, so wow. I was sold down the river by management.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you think about the time that happened in, around 2000, and if you think about shows in and around, I don't know if it was happening exactly then, but like the 11 o'clock show and like The Office, there was still that subversive streak in kind of British comedy generally. And I don't know if that came to a grinding halt with Saxgate when everyone shit the bed a bit. But so you were part of a wider culture there of things like that happening. You know, you think even like with the Radio 1 Breakfast show with Chris Moyles, you know, there was a slightly laddie, you know, there was a sort of bravado and kind of banter element to that. And if you look now, and he's a great broadcaster, but Greg James almost epitomises the opposite of that, isn't he? He's a nice guy, you know, you could trust him, you know, he's never going to do that stuff. I mean,
he's never going to do that.
No, he is never going to do that. But
I'm going to say here and now, there is no way that Greg James will indulge in any kind of soapy titwank at any level.
No.
I'm going to categorically say that.
I would say that these days, Radio 1, probably before they give people the breakfast job, are probably trailing them with ex-KGB agents just to make sure there's no fines like that. But you sort of carried on in radio, and you've done a number of different jobs, and you, there's this sort of strand of comedy where I generally on this show speak to people that have come into comedy through stand-up, you know, principally through stand-up, and yours route has been sort of very different, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. I realized early on, because I always loved radio, and then I did my mum was a nurse, right? So she said, you know, and I was making little, you know, cassettes, remember those kids, you know, when I was a kid, of myself doing radio shows. And my mum said, look, there's hospital radio that exists at the hospital I work at. Or used to work at. So why don't you do that? When I was 16, you have to be 16, I think, to do that. So, and I went in there, and what you end up doing with hospital radio is they won't let you on air until you've had a grounding in going around the hospital getting requests off dying people. And it's a massive eye-opener for a 16-year-old kid who just wants to go on the radio, because you're then standing with just pensioners who are their last breath is sort of saying, "Have you got any Johnny Mathis?"
Or it'd be funny if they had just said "Soapy Titwank," you know. Then
congratulations,
you've won. Can I have a Soapy Titwank, please? Sorry, Bill. I'm afraid we're past that point, mate.
Right. Yeah, I'm just going to give you your last rites instead. But there was a lot of that. Yeah, that was a you had to pass this test of that before they let you on out doing the request show where you know Bill wanted whatever. So and I used to and I did that from 16 to 18 really, like every Tuesday night or something, and then I went to uni and then joined student radio and we ended up doing comedy nights at uni, which wasn't really stand-up, it was more hosting stupid student games and stuff, you know. And then Radio, wanted to do that, came out of college and promptly went to America because couldn't get a job, and then came back and just sent demo tapes off and failed to get any kind of traction whatsoever. Ended up working, doing sound and lighting in a theatre because I could do sound at that point. And then I started writing jokes for Radio 4 Common, like Weekending was an open door policy show back then. And Spitting Image used to take stuff as well for the telly, and I used to sort of send stuff in with no success, very little success to these programs. And then I thought, well, you have to do stand-up to do this. I think you've got to, I want to do comedy. This is what I'm doing, funny stuff, and I want to do, I should do stand-up. And I did it very briefly and very quickly realized that everyone I was gigging with was far better than me at stand-up. And I sort of thought, I know I can do the radio, but this is a bit, this is quite hard. Because I just couldn't remember. I didn't do it often enough to learn the set properly. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And my problem wasn't the material. It was learning it.
I think it's a bit like cricket. You've got to be in the nets. You know what I mean? Like you do. There's a certain repetitious element to it.
Yeah, there is. And I just did not do it enough. And I remember doing a gig very early on with, I think, Howard Reed did it. And Ed Byrne was headlining and, just blew the roof off the place. And I just thought, this isn't for me.
There's got to be other ways of blowing roofs off.
Not an arena.
Yeah.
There's got to be, I can compete over here, but I don't think I can do this anywhere near as well as these people.
Well, I mentioned Ricky Gervais with the 11 o'clock show. That was another sort of way. There were people involved in and around that show that were all coming at it from a different angle. But I do a fair bit of writing for TV still, and you were involved, in radio with like the early Dead Ringers, right? You co-created that.
Yeah.
And that, that had a sort of subversive feel to it because, people forget because impressions aren't as big now. But if you look back to there was that Mike Yarwood era where everyone did the same like three impressions of Frank Bruno, Cilla Black and Frank Spencer.
That's right.
And Prince Charles, Maggie Thatcher, maybe if you were lucky. And then Dead Ringers, not only were they doing like a broader range of, is that partly what you thought was you wanted to open it up a bit and put a bit more into it?
It was, Dead Ringers came about, I was working in the theatre and I got the, and I get at that point I'd had a little bit of success with, I had a Radio 4, a Radio 4 thing where I'd made a demo cassette of a sketch show and I'd gone around and put it on loads of producers' desks. And so that got serious. Well, it was for radio. What it was made for Radio 1. Mm. And then Radio 1 changed. It was back when like Lee and Herring were doing Radio 1 and that kind of stuff, late 90s, I suppose. And then Radio 1 changed, got rid of all the old guard. And that's when they started to bring in, Chris Evans and that era. But they dropped all the comedy. So my series never aired on Radio 1. And instead, Radio 4 sort of took pity on it and broadcast it. But it was a Radio 1 show. So again, reputation had preceded me. And it was a case of going, it got the most complaints that I think Radio 4 had ever had. Because it was a Radio 1 programme. And they just put it on Radio 4. Insane. But anyway, and from that, just cutting a few bits of it out because it took a while, I got the job as in-house writer for BBC Comedy, which still exists now. It's a year's contract, but what it means is you can sort of leave your day job and be in an office in Broadcasting House for a bit. And your job is to come up with programme ideas and write for existing shows. And a producer called Bill Dare, who was sort of quite a legend, he'd done Spitting Image and stuff, stuck his head around the door, I remember, one day and just went, "Oh, look, I've got an idea for an impressions show, Spitting Image on the radio. I've got Alistair McGowan and John Culshaw. Think of something."
Mm. I mean, you already think that'll be quite good, you know. Even if you just even at that stage of the pitch, you go, well, you know, I mean, because
this could work. Yeah. Mm. So it was a great brief. I mean, and then me and my co-writer Andy Hurst. And Simon Blackwell, who listeners may know of, you know, who's gone on to work with Armando Iannucci a lot and does amazing, back right, and Channel 4 stuff. Mate, absolutely brilliant. And he was around as well. So it was me, him, and Andy, I think, wrote the pilot. And then they liked that. And then it started to sort of snowball into, you know, this. But we just, the Radio 1 programme I was talking about ended up on Radio 4. Was called Grievous Bodily Radio, and it was a piss take of all radio, right? Geek, again, radio geek. So, and then it got all these complaints. So what we did was we took some of those sketches, because no one heard it, and put impressions in them, the same jokes, right? Impressions in them. And that was the pilot of Dead Ringers. And everyone loved it. And it, you go, you were complaining about this a year ago, but not anymore, you know.
It's all right when Trevor McDonald says it.
Exactly.
For some reason. I mean, that was what, I mean, when you think about impressions, you go, of course, radio. You know, because as we saw, Dead Ringers went on to become a very successful TV show. But the production values for that, because you sort of got to get the same sets. You've got, for it to work on television, it's got to almost look as good. I did a show, I've never mentioned this on the podcast before, but there was Gina Yashere did a thing called Gina's Laughing Gear on CBBC about 15 years ago. And one of them was called Spoof, which was an impression show. Like, it was kind of junior Dead Ringers. And the listeners are going to love this. If you YouTube hard enough, and I'm not going to make it easy, you will find an image of me dressed as Harry Potter in a Harry Potter sketch. And I would say that I look like a fat John Lennon is what I look like. I don't know why. They gave me the little glasses and stuff. I did not look like Harry Potter. But one thing I remember from that is that they were big sketches. Like, it was a huge production. And I guess you can justify that when shows are getting like 3 to 4 million. But now, if you were to pitch something impressions-based for telly, it would have to be... So we're filming it in people's houses.
Yeah. Well, aren't they just doing one with deepfake? I think I read something, the ITV are doing the first deepfake impression show or something, which sounds tremendously expensive. But I'll be interested to see, you know, how that comes out, because that's quite an interesting idea, I think.
One of the big things that I wanted to discuss in this chat with you, because of the breadth of things that you've worked on, is the health of comedy on TV and radio. Because it sort of strikes me that it's really fucking hard at the moment. You know, like, we're in a world where I always come back to my behaviour, because I think I'm a very average bloke. So if I want to laugh, what do I do? You know, I go probably on TikTok. TikTok makes me laugh a lot. There's a lot of young working class types, quite blunt humour on it. I might watch some of the stand-up special on YouTube or Netflix, you know. And I love, like, terrestrial television and radio, but it's very much not my first port of call for humour. And that's a challenge, isn't it, at the moment?
I sort of know what you mean. I wonder whether that's just a... I don't know whether I've turned into my dad, you know? Mm. And I'm sort of staring at new comedy, if you like, and going, what? Well, this isn't for me. And that's fine, though, isn't it? Because I don't think the things I was watching were for him either.
But just in terms of the audience that things are getting on terrestrial, if you look at, like, you know, what would be seen as, like, a good sitcom now, if it did 600,000, that would be seen as very good business. You know, a topical show doing, like, a million, you know what I mean? It just seems like it's harder to cut through, because it's just an environment now where there's so many other places to get your comedy. And I suppose my sort of not thesis, and this does tie into what happened with you on the Now Show. You were part of Now Show during, you know, what a lot of people call its kind of golden era, with Steve Hugh, yourself, Mitch, Ben, and it was a very stable lineup, it was a very good lineup. And look, it wasn't the most diverse lineup in the world, and it certainly wasn't. And then you were just honest about the reason you were given for, you know, the fact that you no longer associate with the show, which was a producer got in touch or BBC bosses.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. And I was just sort of told that they were going to recast the Now Show, you know, for diversity reasons. Right. And you go, well, OK, you know, that's fine. And I didn't meet. And I just tweeted that, because I didn't think. and I literally just went, and the reason I did it was for a joke. So it's the same reason that Jeremy Clarkson got fired for punching a producer, right?
Yeah.
And it was the same week. So I tweeted, I've just been let go from the Now Show or whatever. And I didn't even punch a producer. So it was just a little joke.
Yeah.
And then, of course, because of that, it snowballed into the male doorstepping my family. I mean, it was an insane couple of weeks.
Yeah, so the story quickly becomes... He was fired for being white or something like that, right?
Which wasn't my story.
No, no, no.
Or anything. I hadn't said that. I hadn't said anything close to it. You know, and all of a sudden that becomes I think we all know how the newspapers work, you know, they twist it into whatever. And it was the Mail who ran with it first. It was the Mail on Sunday. It was the front page of the Mail on Sunday, right?
Was it?
I remember I was, BBC.
That's the most coverage a radio show has ever got, I reckon.
It absolutely is, yeah. It didn't even make the cover of the Radio Times, and that's got the word radio in it. But yeah, it was the front page. I remember I was away at a friend's wedding, and it started, and I got my phone, you know, which was just ringing on Saturday evening. And I was like, what's all these missed calls on a Saturday evening? And it was my agent, and it was this, that, and the other, you know, going, right, you need to know that this is now happening. And I was going, no, what? I'm at a wedding. I'm drunk at a wedding. Leave me alone. And anyway, the next morning, I, you know, sort of wandered down the newsagents because I thought, I've got to get a copy of this. And I walked in, and there, it's such a surreal thing to see yourself on the front of a national paper like that, and your photo and all this. And the worst bit about it, well, there are two terrible bits. One was, it wasn't, the Mail were sort of fairly, you know, they were just beat out to do some BBC bashing because that's what they, that's their agenda, right? But the worst one, surprise, was The Guardian.
No,
who
shit.
Literally just, I know, can you believe it? Who just said, this guy, this racist, privileged guy, just
whinging
online
about,
and I'm like, and all they'd done was copy the Mail story, which wasn't true either.
Yeah.
So, and I'm the guy, and I'm in the front line of this, going, wait a minute, whoa, Guardian, back off.
What most people think.
The other thing that happened, that you just go, they create something they want to create, right? So, you know, I open the newspaper to go to see a picture of me and my wife that they got in a kitchen, right? Now, the kitchen was the biggest kitchen you could imagine, right? It was high end smeg everything, right? With oak this and tables of that, and ornate this and that and the other. And they've just gone, John and his wife, relaxing at home or some shit, right? That isn't our home. What they'd done, some years before, I had written a travel piece about a house in the Cotswolds and whether or not it was child friendly. We took our two children to this, and the house belonged to the, I think it was the bass player of Coldplay's wife. And she rented it out, and the newspaper, a newspaper had gone, can you go and review that holiday home? Because they say it's kid friendly. You've got two little kids. Go and see if it is. And that was the brief. So we went for like 2 days and we stayed in this house, which had stone corners and floors. And it was a death trap for children, or legally speaking, it wasn't a death trap for children. just in case. So the photo, of course, was something the photographer had taken in the bass player of Coldplay's kitchen. Not my house, but now it's now in the paper and on record as my house, isn't it? Because that's...
And I love the inference being that you'd got rich off radio. That's what I love about it. This millionaire, has he not had a good enough run, like just kind of skewing all the profits for all that big radio cheddar? I suppose what's interesting about it at that time was because they had, I mean, if you look at an old episode of Mock the Week, right, I mean, it is weird. You look at like 2005, 2006.
Yeah.
They're not only all straight white blokes, they're all only within about 3 years of each other. There was definitely an issue there. But then what happened in the mid-2010s was suddenly they were like, you know, fuck, we really need to change things. But they were changing things very quickly at a time when there's never been more competition for comedy audience. And I sometimes feel sorry for terrestrial comedy that look, they should have addressed it earlier and done it on a gradual process. I don't know why it took so long in some ways, but that was the problem, wasn't it? Is because, you know, when you change like the kind of composition of panel shows and stuff like that, you inevitably have to bring in less experienced people because that's how you get your experience. And then, you know, the show takes a while to bed in. And that, I don't know what you think, but I just thought it all happened so quickly. It seemed like the worst possible time for topical comedy to have to do that because people suddenly had choice.
Yeah, I think the problem is... a lot of the time, and certainly with the BBC, it's they overcome when a problem is perceived rightly. In the case of Mock the Week, they instead of doing it gradually, as you say, they overcompensate. So they suddenly go, "Oh my, oh shit!" and then do that in a wanna. And you're absolutely right that it should have been because no headlines. There would have been no headlines, not even a story, had that been gradual. It just wouldn't have.
Yeah. It would have put less pressure on the people making their debuts as well.
On the comics, exactly, because now they're in the spotlight and now it wasn't. And I think Dara said similar at the time, didn't he? He just went, this sort of isn't fair now because you're just putting people in the glare of publicity when they're not necessarily ready for it. They haven't had the training. You're throwing them out there to the lions, really.
I had it to a point, you know, when I did stuff, because if you highlight where there's a diversity problem, and then in my case, people talk about the problem of diversity of opinions. When I appeared on this show, you know, certainly when I did the Have I Got News For You, the perception was, well, he's only there for this reason. I suddenly thought, fucking hell, that must have been like, what, black and female. And by the way, if anyone fucking wants to misquote me, I'm not classing my struggle, inverted commas. Oh, God, this is what they do, isn't it? I'm just saying I had a sense temporarily of like, oh, they must have had those tweets all the time. Because the moment it was highlighted, well, we're going to have one woman on every panel, like this bold shout. We're going to have one out of seven. We're going to have one woman. And so it puts that pressure on. But what's been interesting, I think, certainly with topical comedy since then, is that you go, the sort of gauntlet was laid down by Tim Davey. We'll get more diversity of opinion. And actually, since then, all that's happened is topical shows have got cancelled. MASH report went, that's what they've done. They've got, oh, I see your gauntlet, and I refuse the challenge, because the Mock the Week's gone, MASH has gone, the topical 8 out of 10 cats has gone. Actually, if you look, there's just way less topical stuff being made.
I find that quite interesting, and I don't know why, because we've never been at a time when I think topical satire has been more, and not important, that sounds very grand, but do you know what I mean? It, at least it holds a mirror up to something and reflects what we're all thinking. So I do a show called The Skewer on Radio 4, right? Which is, it is topical, but it doesn't have performers, it doesn't have writers in the normal sense. So what we do is we take audio of the news and current affairs, and we mash it up with film and TV, and music and stuff online to create comedy out of it, right? So, give you an example. And the other interesting thing is a lot of it is originated just with angry people rather than comedy people. So there are comedy people who work on it, but a lot of angry nurses get involved and a lot of teachers who just pissed off and send us ideas. So an example I'll give you, back when Matt Hancock was health secretary, somebody who liked the show just got in touch and said, what if, you know, I don't know how to do this because I don't work in this field, but what if Matt Hancock took the NHS to the repair shop on BBC One? And he goes, that is a great idea.
Yeah.
Right. So we made that because it happened that someone on the repair shop was called Matt. So that it tied in. Then we put Matt Hancock's interviews into the repair shop and he's got the NHS there. And so it's all that sort of stuff. Right. Yeah. So and what it does is just it's like a venting mechanism for listeners and contributors alike. And it's an open door policy, so anyone can get involved. But in terms of I think that's necessary, right? And I thought when Spinning Image came back, it didn't, I don't know, it was missing the bite, I think. Interesting that you used to talk about the audience figures, because I find this fascinating. So you're right, if new comedy on, I don't know, BBC Three or whatever, right? You're right, if they get 600,000, half a million, right? They're over the moon with that.
It's a hit.
It is a hit. But yet it'll get loads of publicity because it's telly. And similarly, if even the big hitters get, you know, one and a bit, don't they? Radio comedy, right? Ready for the Now Show gets about 3 million, like every week. The Skewer is on at 11 o'clock at night, over a million, and that's just linear. That's just people listening as it's on.
Great numbers.
Yeah. So, but no one gives a shit. It's like well, instead on the front of the Radio Times will be the BBC Three thing, you know, no one's watching. It's like and plus don't get me started on the budgets. I mean, I know we don't have to pay for
cameras. No, let's get started on the budgets, please.
But bloody hell, right? If you write a TV script, you get whatever you get. Radio script, it's no less work, is it? It's still writing jokes on a page.
Yeah.
I don't know, a third of the rate or something? It's insane.
And then that's the funny thing is that often, you know, with radio, one of the things that they'll say, well, you want to be doing this, you know, and the reason that they give for it not being as much money is it's got a great audience. You go, well, that's easily an argument for it being more money. I mean, you Okay, just interrupting the chat there with John. I hope you're enjoying it. And I hope you're enjoying the sound of an ad-free podcast here. Very rare, beautiful thing. You know, you see them in the wild sometimes, right? It's like a fucking rare beast. No adverts. You don't suddenly, you know, I'm not going to suddenly start talking to you about some home cooking thing that I'm getting. If it was me, though, you know, some of my friends are celebrities, like, they get the top range home cooking stuff like Gusto and fucking Box Fresh. If it was me, I don't know what, like, if I was to get an advertising thing, it'd be like Weatherspoons cook from home. You know, like, whatever frozen stuff that they have and then they just fucking fry in the kitchens. New Weatherspoons. I'm Jeff Norcott, and if you're like me, you love Weatherspoons food. And I sometimes think, I can't make it to a Weatherspoons. What if I could cook it from home? Well, with new Weatherspoons from home Weatherspoons, home spoons, home spooning, like homeschooling, I can have all the great Weatherspoons menu at home. This week, I had ale pie and weird creamy salty mash. And tomorrow for breakfast, I'm going to be doing a really minging looking fry up. So home spoons. So you don't have any of that. Homes, by the way, Weatherspoons, if you even dare fucking try and roll that out, giving me a piece of love on the advertising or the IP. I want the intellectual property for Homespoons. So yeah, the way that's achieved is by the Patreon, keeping it weekly and ad-free. If you see, you know, I haven't missed a week since early 2020. So thank you very much to all the patrons for keeping it that way. We got a couple of new ones to say hello to. Danny Peters. Danny Peters, you absolute fucking lad. Danny Peters. Is Danny Peters coming? It's Danny Peters. Do you remember that time Danny Peters got chucked out of Oceania for getting his cock out? Oh my God. I'm not approving of getting your cock out. But everyone had a mate back in the 90s that did it. Everyone had just he's got his cock out. No one would be a bloke with a large cock. The thing with a bloke with large penises is that I guess it's a bit like having a superpower, and they just don't get to tell anybody that often. So every once in a while, they'll just get it out. And, you know, often it will be, I don't think women ever really want to see that in public, but it'll sometimes get a round of applause off the men. Chris James. Why did Chris James, you just sound like a DJ on Absolute Radio. Chris James. Chris James. You're one of those greedy guys. I'm just going to have as many first names as possible. Have you got a middle name? You got a middle name as well? Chris James Phil. I wonder, what are some most first names that anybody's ever had as part of just their normal name? Email in whatmostpeoplethinkuk@gmail.com. And just a reminder, so, you know, the board members are getting their special gift. The VIP members, when I do the January online show, you'll get guaranteed front row access to watch that online, if you so wish. And I'll be announcing the date for that in due course. There are many people that have got their codes for the Jeff Norcott and Friends gigs coming up next year. And I can announce I will be doing a work in progress tour in the spring next year. So you'll get early access for that. I don't know why I slowed down like that. Let's get back to the chat with John Holmes. I mean, it's weird because we both discussed this thing about being straight white blokes and not wanting to seem like you're moaning. But it's a simple reality of comedy, is it not? That almost everybody that works in the industry holds a relatively similar worldview, right? That's not whinging. That is kind of, maybe writers are a bit different, actually. But like TV comedy, you know, I would work on stuff either as a writer or in front of the screen. And I would say that quite often I was within a production staff of about 30 people. I was certainly the only Tory there that would admit it, you know, same with being a Leave voter. And it's because it's just inevitable that creates a kind of groupthink, right?
I think it is. I think it's getting better. I mean, and again, we've touched on this. My thing has always been the class thing because, you know, working class, mum, a nurse, dad, a builder, you know, grow up, first person to go to university in my family, all that stuff. And that's before I stopped playing the card of going, and I was adopted, at 4 weeks old, and because I'm making a documentary about adoption at the moment because, I don't, you know, this is a slight aside, but in the sort of late 60s, early 70s, when I was born, we were still taken off our mums because they were single. You know, and they were forced, it's a scandal, really. They were forced to give birth without any painkillers to teach them a lesson. And this is as recent as 1976.
Yeah.
Right? And it's utterly insane. So, you know, and I was a doctor. I'm, you know, recently sort of been going through my journey, as I believe we have to say, and just trying to find out kind of what happened and all of that. But the class thing's so important, and 40% of this country are working class, right? And you talk about representation in the media, You know, now I was talking to Marcus Ryder about this. He's the guy who's the head of the Lenny Henry Center for Media Diversity, right? And he was talking about representation of black people on screen and behind screen and what the figures are and everything else. Quite interesting. Because I think I'll get these figures wrong, won't I? But it's something like 3% of people of color in this country, but there's now late teen, you know, some representation in the media as well. But working class people, right? 40% of the country. How many working class people do you know who are on the telly, you know, presenting stuff? Well, it's you. You know, it's...
Well, but more so in production, as I found. It's like,
and in production,
because you could actually, you know, you can change the numbers on the screen relatively quickly. You know, if you only have two hosts and one of them comes from a working class background, you've already, you know, done 50%. But if you've got 30 people working on that production, that's people will never see that diversity. And I remember like doing these meetings and stuff. But what I sort of realized after a while was that if you had like a cause that people wanted to champion, right? Class was one that everyone was like, no, this is a thing. But if you think of a cab off the rank, right? It was never going to be the first cab off the rank. That's what I realised. Because if you get like your Metropolitan Liberal, they're just, you know, what's going to make them feel good? It's not going to be getting like a 19-year-old panel beater from Wigan called Wayne a job as a runner at Zeppotron, is it?
No.
they'll all admit Wayne.
But that's the point. That's what it should be. And I hope that it will be the next big issue that people start fighting for, because talk about the Center for Media Diversity. Well, you're not talking about that side of it. You know, you've got to start thinking about getting the panel beater into Zeppotron. And how does that work? I remember one of the early writers meetings I went to for a show, just when I was kind of really first in industry. And again, it was a room full of writers. Okay. They were probably back then 20 odd years ago, all straight white men. Right. So there was that, but I was certainly the only working class person. I mean, the rest of them were Oxbridge. I mean, without a doubt, or Durham, right? And I, you know, bloke from the Neaton, and I turned up, and they were doing, there were script notes in Latin. I didn't know what that meant or was, but I felt compelled to try to join in. But I didn't say, sorry, I didn't stop and go, sorry, I don't know what this is. I went to Higham Lane Comprehensive, you know. I don't know what this means. Can somebody bloody explain the Latin to me?
Basically.
But I remember sitting there thinking, feeling so out of my depth.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which was wrong. I should have felt, of course I belong there. I'm part of the nation. Come on. So I do, you know, I do see that how, to use that modern word, inclusivity, you know, is so important, but you really have to widen those boundaries to get.
Well, that's the point. Is if you say, if you're saying like the BBC do have this unique pressure to represent, where you go, well, because of the license fee, where you go, well, it has to include class and it has to include opinion. You know, so I think that the people at the top of the BBC get this. They really do. You know, like I've been in meetings, they do get it. It's how once you get down all the way down to the line of a production company, you know, of kind of like 35 to 45 year old type liberal metropolitans, it's never going to be high up their priority list to make a program that reflects those things. Now, financially, they might eventually realize, well, that's what the BBC keep asking us for. We better fucking do it. That's just not what gets them out of bed maybe creatively in the morning. And I suppose when we talk about our panel beater Wayne from Wigan 19, you know, Wayne maybe is the guy that they've always felt a bit scared of on the train station, you know what I mean, like standing on a platform. Maybe Wayne shouted something at him out of a van. maybe we need to have like some of these, you know, these weird professional development meetings where we have like a role play with Wayne where they can sort of speak to him and sort of say, Wayne, I just feel like you're going to beat me up, Wayne. I just feel like you're just going to punch me in the face at some point. And then they can get their fears out and then they'll feel more comfortable about having Waynes in the workplace.
Yeah. I think, you know, if you get your Wayne in a workplace, it's only going to improve things, because Wayne is going to bring a point of view that your company doesn't have. And that's only going to make it stronger. And that's diversity. That's how it works. It's genuine diversity, because you're getting all opinions and all walks of life.
You're doing your own bit in terms of representing diversity of voices in terms of this this Radio 4 commission. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, you're talking about Unsafe Space, right? So we did a pilot. And again, as part of that diversity push, when Tim Davies said we should have more of it. I went to Radio 4 and I said, right, you don't have diversity of thought, right? You've got most of your comedy programs, broadly, as you say, there are pockets with yourself and Simon on the Simon Evans on the news, Chris and everything else, but what you don't really have is working class people in a program so much. You don't have anything that goes against the grain, that sort of has those opinions that aren't fashionable amongst those metropolitan elite, the dissenting voices against the received narrative, shall we say.
Yeah, the liberal, right? Orthodoxy.
Yeah, so I said, so we should do a program like that. And I said, but it's Radio 4, so it will be grown up. You know, what we'll do is we'll have some stand-ups that you wouldn't normally have, right, that wouldn't come near Radio 4. And in fact, who you wouldn't even invite on the Now show, probably. But let's have a show with these people on. But we'll also get debate in there and chat. And the sort of people who do, we'll invite the people who scream at each other on Twitter and put them in a room, a pub perhaps, to be convivial, where they can talk about these things rather than just 140 characters. So we did a pilot and it went really well. Again, possibly because the Radio 4 audience were like, oh, finally, something... Something
well,
that's
blow me
not,
down.
Yes, look at this. Opinions that I agree with, or whatever it might be. So anyway, we've got a series and that starts in January. And we've been recording loads of stand-up gigs and putting stand-up gigs on with, again, voices and comics. Not yourself, because you're already all over Radio 4 like a rash, aren't you? But you know what I mean? We're getting people on who wouldn't normally, but with some solid Radio 4 performers as well. Simon Evans is doing, right? But Simon's not doing stand-ups. He's writing an essay column and doing an essay for us each week, intercut with interviews with people who have a right to reply against his essay. If you saw what I mean. So, and Andrew Doyle is doing stuff for us. He's going to interview. So he's interviewing Owen Jones, who are two people who are often.
Finally, the Doyle Jones thing. Well, that's box office, isn't it? There's a lot of people that want to.
Yeah. Listen to that.
I mean, Owen will have a chat. That's the thing is, I know he gets a lot of stick on sort of like that side of the fence, but he will actually have a chat with people and he's got a track record of doing that. So that I think will be well worth listening to. And I think one of the things that perhaps producers and stuff have to overcome is this fear factor of like, well, what are they going to say? Like they seem to think that the idea that you're not like a lot of us would genuinely say we're being fully censored, but that certain viewpoints don't have a platform. We're like, well, what do you want to say? Do you just want to say the bad words? You're like, no, because modern audiences would tell you to fuck off. If you went out and were like genuinely unpleasant and brutal about minorities or disadvantaged people, like how first up, the jokes would have to be amazing. I mean, that is to even get a laugh. The writing would be it would be worth putting on just because the jokes would have to be that good. I don't know anybody that really wants to go out and do that comedically.
No, not and have a sustainable career, or not certainly not get any. I think there are probably a lot of people doing it. You know, in you know, like Roy Chubby Brown still makes a good living out of being what you could argue is as provocative as possible. But he's got an audience and they follow him around. It's a bit like it's sort of like it's like the Stuart Lee thing, isn't it? He's like, you know, Stuart has that thing of going, right, I know my audience now and I can make a living by going to these, you know, probably mid-sized to bigger venues and I'll do a tour a year and that's my living and that's fine. And he said that. Roy Chubby Brown, same thing. What I'll do is I'll put a DVD, how old-fashioned, at Christmas, and then I'll play, you know, the whatever halls in Regional Arts Centre, and my audience will come and see me. But you're absolutely right. Outside of that, and certainly comics coming through, are never going to go and say the things they're accused of, are they? And, I mean, I've seen, you know... for the pilot, right, we got loads of flack when we did the pilot, because... Chortle or whoever it was put it up as a sort of you know, a right-wing comedy show, which it never, again, not in the press release, no one said that.
Loads of left-wing performers on the lineup, which
loads sort of them, you know, just people who
too many had, I would argue but they, that's another
but it was literally a diverse lineup, I mean, in all senses of the word, but no, it's a right-wing thing. And we got people, and this is why that element of the left wing, I think, kind of deluded, because you go that they threatened to, we had to get extra security in on radio budgets, right?
Wow.
To stop the gig being disrupted, because the moment they found out Andrew Doyle was involved, because he was in the lineup, they threatened to, we had to go to the BBC and go, right, so this is a Radio 4 recording, right? It's pretty grown up, right? yet there are people threatening to turn up with air horns that they'll blast throughout the recording to ruin the recording. So no one, this show can't possibly be broadcast, right? Actual threats, like to Andrew, to me, because I'm producing it, right? And we'll come in and let's just bulk the tickets, which are free because it's BBC, right? And we'll all turn up and we'll just sit there in silence or not turn up. And then it'll be an empty room. Ha, ha, ha. They won't be able to broadcast it. Ha, 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 ha. Air horns. Right? And we had to get security to stop that happening. That's, you go, this is insane. What are you trying to achieve? There's just some people doing jokes on the stage. And all the jokes they said we were going to do didn't materialise because that's not going to happen. No one's mocking trans people. No one's having a go at people's rights. There's just some jokes about how the prevailing thought is.
Yeah, God, it's just so... I think people listening will be as annoyed as I am just to hear that people try to shut it down. It's just... it's ignorance in its purest form.
That was part of the reason for trying to do this series on Safe Space is because debate, it seems to me, or it's a grown-up debate, is shut down and stifled, literally with air horns in this case. So the idea of putting Owen Jones and Andrew Doyle and Billy Bragg's coming on, right? So, because Billy Bragg's been very vocal about freedom of speech recently, but about how there should be consequences, you know, and he's talked about J.K. Rowling and all this sort of stuff, right? That's quite an interesting point of view to have him chatting to Andrew about, I think, you know. But because it's Radio 4, you can go, yeah, it's quite sensible. You know, it's a comedy show, but we've got some debate in it. And I think the more of that, the better, you know. I don't think Billy's going to bring an air horn, put it that way. You know, it's like he might bring his guitar, but it's not, it shouldn't be like that. And I think you know, as a sort of looking at it overview, you know, I got an insight into that when we talked about the front page of the Mail nightmare. What I found was, as the sort of pawn in the game, was I got the right wing, the very right wing, having a go at me. People were sending me death threats, naturally, right? But they'd be quite... A lot of people sent that meme of, and they put my face on it, of me sitting on a branch, sawing it off behind myself. With the sort of, and they were going, well, if you again, they don't know me, they go, you know, you middle class liberal, you know, this is what you get, isn't it, if you're middle class liberal, you're hoist by your own petard, aren't you,
collude, yeah, like the Vichy regime,
sawing it off behind you because this is what happens to the likes of you. And then on the other hand, I'm a complete racist because apparently I'm a white privileged something. You know, and you go, no, I'm not. No, I'm none of these things. I'm a nuanced person, and I happen to think some things that might be a bit right. I also think some things are a bit left because I'm a human, and I absorb it all. You know, I read all of the press.
Yeah,
you know, I read the Spectator, but I also look at the New States because I like to absorb all opinions and inform my own. You mad people!
I mean, I already want to hear this, you know, straight away. But I know that you're in the edit for it. When is it likely to be broadcast?
It starts second week of January. Yeah,
Week of January.
Yeah. Yeah, six-week run, yeah.
I mean, make a date in your diaries, everybody, for that. And John Holmes, look, I hope this isn't the last time that you come on the podcast because I feel like
I enjoyed it. It's quite a refreshing chat.
Thank you so much for appearing on the show.
Pleasure, Jeff. Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, so that was the chat with John Holmes there. And there was just so much in there. You know, it's so interesting to speak to somebody in comedy that is coming at it from a different angle. So do check out all this stuff. Check out his Radio 4 show. And also keep your eyes peeled for Unsafe Space, which is coming out on Radio 4 early in the new year. Just a few reviews here before we go. If you could leave them 5 stars, please, on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from. It does matter. I found out recently that when people decide whether or not to go on shows, they look at how many reviews they've had as a sign, you know, of whether or not it's a well listened to show. I'm currently on 1400, which, as I say, is probably less than 10% of the people that listen. So if you haven't reviewed, you just got even just 5 stars, one word, like it. Now I realise that I'm going to get loads of those, and it will look like I've paid some fucking bot at a bot farm in Bangladesh to do it. But just some short pithy review, that'd be awesome. So the review here is, I've got to read this one in a Yam Yams accent. This one says, best podcast and advert free. Been listening to the podcast from the beginning. I always remember thinking, yeah, right, Jeff, advert free, ain't going to happen. But how wrong I was. Thanks to his loyal supporters and board members, Jeff says it as it is and look forward to listening each week with the joy of not hearing fake chat about how he loves a craft beer and saving a third on rail fares. I hear what you're saying there. Are you saying, mate, Mark, that some people that advertise cheap rail fares on their podcast only ever sit in first class? Fucking very dare you. How very dare you? Celebrities are all exactly what they seem to be. This is from Paul K. Paul K sounds like a bit of a cockney. Loving it. Genius at work. I was late to the podcast after having a super chuckle at him. Oh, in Solihull. I read this one last week. So we've had one new review since last week. I reckon we could do better than that. If we get it up to, like, I don't know, it's 1,400 reviews now. If we can get it up in, you know, in a few months to 2,000, who knows what fucking guests I could get on here. But enjoy the rest of your week or weekend. And just remember, if someone says, isn't it cold? Just go, no. Even if you're standing there, like, properly bobble hat on, fucking mittens, gloves, scarf, just go, no. Just stare them in the face. Isn't it cold? No. See you next week.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.